So today we begin with the realization of Satchitananda, because the last time we read, I think, two times the modes of the self. And this is chapter 12 on page 383 in the new edition, part two of the synthesis of yoga of Sri Aurobindo. I think I didn't forget. I forgot any data. But before that, we make a couple of minutes of meditation. Who
Do
has
we
a
see
bell?
the sequence of reading first?
The sequence of reading is first me, then you, Andrea, and then John Robert. But it's irrelevant. The gallery. Oh no. In the gallery mode, it's first John Robert, then me, then Andrea. It's better John Robert begins. I don't want to be the first. Okay. John Robert, me, and then Andrea.
Chapter 12, The Realization of Satchitananda. The modes of the self, which we have dealt with in our last chapter, may seem at first to be of a highly metaphysical character, to be intellectual conceptions more fit for philosophical analysis than for practical realization. But this is a false distinction made by the division of our faculties. It is at least a fundamental principle of the ancient wisdom, the wisdom of the East on which we are founding ourselves, that philosophy ought not to be merely a lofty intellectual pastime or play of dialectical subtlety, or even a pursuit of metaphysical truth for its own sake, but a discovery by all right means of the basic truths of all existence, which ought then to become the guiding principles of our own existence. Sankhya, The abstract and analytical realization of truth is one side of knowledge. Yoga, the concrete and synthetic realization of it in our experience, inner state, outer life, is the other. Both are means by which man can escape out of falsehood and ignorance and live in and by the truth. And since it is always the highest he can know or be capable of, that must be the aim of the thinking man, it is the highest truth which the soul must seek out by thought and by life accomplished.
Here lies the whole importance of the part of the yoga of knowledge, which we are now considering, the knowledge. In the footnote, he describes it with the Sanskrit word tattva-jnana, the knowledge tattva-jnana, of those essential principles of being, those essential modes of self-existence on which the absolute divine has based its self-manifestation. If the truth of our being is an infinite unity in which alone there is perfect whiteness, light, knowledge, power, bliss, and if all our subjection to darkness, ignorance, weakness, sorrow, limitation comes of our viewing existence as a clash of infinitely multiple separate existences, then obviously it is the most practical and concrete and utilitarian, as well as the most lofty and philosophical wisdom, to find a means by which we can get away from the error and learn to live in the truth. So also, if that one is in its nature a freedom from the bondage to display of qualities which constitute our psychological, and if from subjection to that play are born the struggle and discords in which we live, floundering eternally between the two poles of good and evil, virtue and sin, satisfaction and failure, joy and grief, pleasure and pain, then to get beyond the qualities and take our foundation in the settled peace of that which is always beyond them is the only practical wisdom. If attachment to mutable personality is the cause of our self-ignorance, our discord and quarrel with ourselves and with life and with others, and if there is an impersonal one in which no such discord and ignorance and vain and noisy effort exists because it is in eternal identity and harmony with itself, then to arrive in our souls at the impersonality and untroubled oneness of being is the one line and object of human effort to which our reason can consent to give the name of practicality.
I like how that ends there.
Yeah, I think I have to read this again later, eventually. You can, because it trickles through and I don't capture it.
Excuse me. Yeah. There is such a unity, impersonality, freedom from the play of qualities, which lifts us above the strife and surge of nature in her eternal seeking through mind and body for the true key and secret of all our relations. And it is the ancient highest experience of mankind that only by arriving there, only by making oneself impersonal, one, still, self-gathered, superior to the mental and vital existence in that which is eternally superior to it, can a settled, because self-existent peace and internal freedom be acquired. That's one of Sri Aurobindo's sentences. Therefore, this is the first, in a sense, the characteristic and essential object of the yoga of knowledge. But as we have insisted, this, if first, is not all. If the essential, it is not the complete object. Knowledge is not complete if it merely shows us how to get away from relations to that which is beyond relations, from personality to impersonality, from multiplicity to featureless unity. It must give us also that key, that secret of the whole play of relations, the whole variation of multiplicity, the whole clash and interaction of personalities for which cosmic existence is seeking. And knowledge is still incomplete if it gives us only an idea and cannot verify it in experience. We seek the key, the secret, in order that we may govern the phenomenon by the reality it represents, heal its discords by the hidden principle of concord and unification behind them, and arrive from the converging and diverging effort of the world to the harmony of its fulfillment. Not merely peace, but fulfillment is what the heart of the world is seeking, and what a perfect and effective self-knowledge must give to it. Peace can only be the eternal support, the infinite condition, the natural atmosphere of self-fulfillment.
Moreover, the knowledge that finds the true secret of multiplicity, personality, quality, play of relations must show us some real oneness in essence of being, an intimate unity in power of being between the impersonal and the source of personality, the qualityless and that which expresses itself in qualities, the unity of existence and its many-featured multiplicity. The knowledge that leaves a yawning gulf between the two can be no ultimate knowledge, however logical it may seem to the analytical intellect, or however satisfactory to a self-dividing experience. True knowledge must arrive at a oneness which embraces, even though it exceeds, the totality of things, not in a oneness which is incapable of it and rejects it. For there can be no such original, unbridgeable chasm of duality, either in the all existence itself or between any transcendent oneness and the all existent. And as in knowledge, so in experience and self-fulfillment. The experience which finds at the summit of things such an original, unbridgeable chasm between two contrary principles, and can at most succeed in overleaping it so that it has to live in one or the other, but cannot embrace and unify, is not the ultimate experience. Whether we seek to know by thought or by the vision of knowledge which surpasses thought, or by that perfect self-experience in our own being, which is the crown and fulfillment of realization by knowledge, we must be able to think out, see, experience, and live the all-satisfying unity. This is what we find in the conception, vision and experience of the one whose oneness does not cease or disappear from view by self-expression in the many, who is free from bondage to qualities, but is yet infinite quality, who contains and combines all relations, yet is ever absolute, who is no one person, and yet all persons, because he is all being and the one conscious being. For the individual center we call ourselves, to enter by its consciousness into this divine and reproduce its nature in itself is the high and marvelous, yet perfectly rational, and most supremely pragmatic and utilitarian goal before us. It is the fulfillment of our self-existence, and at the same time, the fulfillment of our cosmic existence, of the individual in himself and the individual in his relation to the cosmic many. Between these two terms, there's no irreconcilable opposition. Rather, our own self and the self of the cosmos, having been discovered to be one, there must be between them an intimate unity.
In fact, all these opposite terms are merely general conditions for the manifestation of conscious being, that transcendent, who is always one, not only behind, but within all conditions, however, apparently opposite. And the original unifying spirit stuff of them all and the one substantial mode of them all is that which has been described for the convenience of our thought as a trinity of Satchitananda. Existence, consciousness, bliss, these are everywhere the three inseparable divine terms. None of them is really separate. Though our mind and our mental experience can make not only the distinction, but the separation. Mind can say and think, I was, but unconscious. For no being can say, I am, but unconscious. And it can think and feel, I am, but miserable and without any pleasure in existence. In reality, this is impossible. The existence we really are, the eternal I am, of which it can never be true to say it was, is nowhere and at no times unconscious. What we call unconsciousness is simply other consciousness. It is the going in of the surface wave of our mental awareness of our objects into our subliminal self-awareness and into our awareness too of other planes of existence. We are really no more unconscious when we are asleep or stunned or drugged or dead or in any other state than when we are plunged in inner thought, oblivious of our physical selves and our surroundings. For anyone who has advanced even a little way in yoga, this is most elementary proposition and one which offers no difficulty whatever to the thought because it is proved at every point by experience. It is more difficult to realize that existence and undelight of existence cannot go together. What we call misery, grief, pain, absence of delight is again merely a surface way of the delight of existence, which takes on to our mental experience these apparently opposite tints because of a certain trick of false reception in our divided being, which is not our existence at all, but only a fragmentary formulation or discolored spray of conscious force tossed up by the infinite sea of our self-existence. In order to realize this, we have to get away from our absorption in these surface habits, these petty tricks of our mental being, and when we do get behind away from them, it is surprising how superficial they are. What ridiculous, weak, and little penetrating pinpricks they prove to be. And we have to realize true existence and true consciousness and true experience of existence and consciousness, Sat, Chit, and Ananda. Whew. Yeah, the first part I can relate. The second part is hard. to accept
he's,
and to.
He's really having a good time with this, with these paragraphs.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, and clearly he's there because that's why he can make so little of it. You know, we are in it. It's.
Yeah.
It sounds all very easy.
Yeah, because I mean, how many have this experience? He cites this also somewhere else where he says that pain can be transformed, not in pleasure. He says delight, no?
In
ananda. Ecstasy, yeah. Ananda.
Pain, ecstasy, yeah.
And by the way, he distinguishes between pleasure and ecstasy. He says it's very two different things. But yeah, I don't know about you, but I have to work on that. When I have toothache or some pain. I tried many times, but
right, it's not easy.
Yeah. Whereas I can relate very much to the first part where he says this thing with I was but unconscious. This is very typical. You hear people saying this over and over again. That, oh, when you have anesthesia, you are unconscious. But just think about a little moment. Do you remember when you were a baby? I don't remember. Anyway, at least not until some age. Were I unconscious? No. I just don't recall. But it's just easy as that. You don't remember. And it's my experience that I very frequently wake up in the morning, don't remember any dream, and say, oh, I didn't exist. Yeah, I was unconscious. I didn't exist. And then suddenly, in a fraction of a second, some pieces, fragments of a dream come up, I said, ah, no, I was dreaming something. Oh, then I existed, and suddenly I existed in that moment where I was dreaming. And which shows me it's just a matter of memory. Yeah. But try to explain this to some people. they don't accept this. No, I was unconscious. But how do you know? You didn't remember. Huh? So, yeah, this is... something that they have frequent discussion with people about this point. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Chit, the divine consciousness, is not our mental self-awareness that we shall find to be only a form, a lower and limited mode or movement. As we progress and awaken to the soul in us and things, we shall realize to the soul in us and things, we shall realize that there is a consciousness also in the plant, in the metal, in the atom, in electricity, in everything that belongs to physical nature. We shall find even that it is not really in all respects a lower or more limited mode than the mental. On the contrary, it is in many inanimate forms more intense, rapid, poignant, though less evolved towards the surface. Oh, this is a wonderful explanation. Because we feel that, and I know you have, feel that in nature, you can get in touch when you are out of your regular mind. You can feel the presence of consciousness in the rocks, in the plants. And... here, this is a wonderful description. It can be more intense, rapid, poignant, though less evolved towards the surface, which is where we live most of the time. Okay. But this also, this consciousness of vital and physical nature is compared with chit, a lower and therefore limited form, mode, and movement. These lower modes of consciousness are the conscious stuff of inferior planes in one indivisible existence. In ourselves also, there is in our subconscious being an action which is precisely that of the inanimate physical nature, whence has been constituted the basis of our physical being, another which is that of plant life, and another which is that of the lower animal creation around us. All these are so much dominated and conditioned by the thinking and reasoning conscious being in us that we have no real awareness of these lower planes. I must say, I'm kind of sorry that he keeps calling them lower. Anyway, we are unable to perceive in their own terms what these parts of us are doing, and receive it very imperfectly in the terms and values of the thinking and reasoning mind. Still, we know well enough that there is in an animal in us, that there is an animal in us as well as that which is characteristically human, something which is a creature of conscious instinct and impulse, not reflective or rational, as well as that which turns back in thought and will on its experience, meets it from above with the light and force of the higher plane, and to some degree controls, uses, and modifies it. But the animal in man is only the head of our subhuman being. Below it, there is much that is also subanimal and merely vital, much that acts by an instinct and impulse of which the constituting consciousness is withdrawn behind the surface. Below this subanimal being, there is at a further depth the subvital. When we advance in that ultra-normal self-knowledge and experience which yoga brings with it, we become aware that the body too has a consciousness of its own. It has habits, impulses, instincts, an inert yet effective will, which differs from that of the rest of our being, and can resist it and condition its effectiveness. Much of the struggle in our being is due to this composite existence, and the interaction of these varied and heterogeneous planes on each other. For man here is the result of an evolution and contains in himself the whole of that evolution up from the merely physical and subvital conscious being to the mental creature, which at the top he is.
But this evolution is really a manifestation, and just as we have in us these subnormal selves and subhuman planes, so are there in us, above our mental being, supernormal and superhuman planes. There, chit, as the universal conscious stuff of existence, takes other poises, moves out in other modes, on other principles, and by other faculties of action. There is above the mind, as the old Vedic sages discovered, a truth plane, a plane of self-luminous, self-effective idea, which can be turned in light and force upon our mind, reason, sentiments, impulses, sensations, and use and control them in the sense of the real truth of things, just as we turn our mental reason and will upon our sense experience and animal nature to use and control them in the sense of our rational and moral perceptions. There is no seeking, but rather natural possession. No conflict or separation between will and reason, instinct and impulse, desire and experience, idea and reality. But all are in harmony, concomitant, mutually effective, unified in their origin, in their development, and in their effectuation. But beyond this plane and attainable through it are others in which the very chit itself becomes revealed. Chit, the elemental origin and primal completeness of all this varied consciousness, which is here used for various formation and experience. There will and knowledge and sensation and all the rest of our faculties, powers, modes of experience are not merely harmonious, concomitant, unified, but are one being of consciousness and power of consciousness. It is this chit which modifies itself so as to become, on the truth plane, the supermind. On the mental plane, the mental reason, will, emotion, sensation. On the lower planes, the vital or physical instincts, impulses, habits of an obscure force, not in superficially conscious possession of itself. All is chit because all is sat. All is various movement of the original consciousness because all is various movement of the original being.
When we find see or know chit, we find also that its essence is ananda or delight of self-existence. To possess self is to possess self-bliss. Not to possess self is to be in more or less obscure search of the delight of existence. Chit eternally possesses its self-bliss. And since chit is the universal conscious stuff of being, conscious universal being is also in possession of conscious self-bliss, master of the universal delight of existence. The divine, whether it manifests itself in all quality or in no quality, in personality or impersonality, in the one absorbing the many or in the one manifesting its essential multiplicity, is always in possession of self-bliss and all bliss because it is always Satchitananda. For us also to know and possess our true self in the essential and the universal is to discover the essential and the universal delight of existence, self-bliss, and all bliss. For the universal is only the pouring out of the essential existence, consciousness, and delight. And wherever and in whatever form that manifests as existence, there is the essential consciousness must be, and therefore there must be an essential delight. No, the last sentence, I read it again. For the universal is only the pouring out of the essential existence, consciousness and delight. And wherever and in whatever form that manifests as existence, there the essential consciousness must be, and therefore there must be an essential delight.
The individual soul does not possess this true nature of itself or realize this true nature of its experience because it separates itself both from the essential and the universal and identifies itself with the separate accidents, with the unessential form and mode, and with the separate aspect and vehicle. Thus, it takes its mind-body life stream for its essential self. It tries to assert these for their own sake against the universal, against that of which the universal is the manifestation. It is right in trying to assert and fulfill itself in the universal for the sake of something greater and beyond, but wrong in attempting to do it against the universal and in obedience to a fragmentary aspect of the universal. This fragmentary aspect, or rather collection of fragmentary experiences, it combines around an artificial center of mental experience, the mental ego, and calls that itself, and it serves this ego and lives for its sake instead of living for the sake of that something greater and beyond of which all aspects, even the widest and most general, are partial manifestations. This is the living in the false and not the true self. This is living for the sake of and in obedience to the ego and not for the sake of and in obedience to the divine. The question how this fall has come about and for what purpose it has been done belongs to the domain of Sankhya rather than of yoga. We have to seize on the practical fact that two such self-division is due the self-limitation by which we have become unable to possess the true nature of being and experience, and are therefore in our mind, life, and body subject to ignorance, incapacity, and suffering. Non-possession of unity is the root cause. To recover unity is the sovereign means. Unity with the universal and with that which the universal is here to express. We have to realize the true self of ourselves and of all. And to realize the true self is to realize Satchit Ananda.
I like the conclusion. Sometimes understanding what Sri Aurobindo is trying to convey, it's sometimes better to begin from the end, read the last sentences and see what was the sense of all that. So, and here he summarizes all very often what he was going to say in the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, this concept of unity, this is coming up in our society now. We are now speaking that you are one humankind, one great family. Still far from realizing this in the practice, very far. One has only to read the news, but the impulse is all there. And one can see it all also in the and the happenings, what happens in the world. Think of the internet, for example. I don't think that the internet is just a technological phenomenon. It is the expression of an inner psyche of humanity to begin at least this path towards unity. It is the first step. It's not. In a sense, the internet can also divide. but I think it has created a strong force and drive towards this global mind that also Talek de Chardin was predicting. You know, this paleontologist and French philosopher and priest. Who saw this, the coming of this global mind. I don't know what was the name. Oof, it escapes now my mind.
The noosphere.
In the noosphere, yes. Thank you, John Robert. The noosphere. And it's real. And I think it is deep down, at the occult level, that's Satchit Ananda. Satchit Ananda that is working on the surface to realize what it is already at a transcendent level. I'm philosophizing again.
Yeah, no, I always think that the first moment of the collective awakening of humanity about unity was when we saw the earth from the moon. From space, when we all saw this incredible, I mean, talk about bliss. I mean, you can't imagine, I mean, there's nothing more beautiful than the earth in the universe. That's how I feel, you know, so far. And that we saw that how small and how it looks like a living being, how it actually is a living being, you know, it's moving all the time. And it's changing all the time. So the whole thing is alive. And that we had, I think, our first collective awareness, beginning of awareness of that then. Does somebody remember the year that we saw this? When we went to the moon? Was that 69?
The moon was 69, I think. 68 or 69. But that photograph that you mentioned was, I think, in 66 or 67, because it was when the astronauts went behind the moon, but did not land on the moon and then returned. That's what we are doing.
So the first ones did not turn the camera around?
No, the photograph of the moon, of the Earth on the horizon of the moon, famous photograph.
I mean, just the Earth by itself in space.
Ah, by itself, okay. Okay.
I think the first ones, they were totally trained to look at the moon. And then suddenly decided to look back to Earth, and he saw it. And you see just the Earth in space. It's incredibly blue and white. And
By the way, the Earth is not so small. It's the biggest solid planet of the solar system. There is no other planet which is bigger than the Earth.
Solid planet.
Because there, Jupiter is much bigger, but it is just a ball of gas. It's a sphere of gas. If you cannot land on it, you just would sink into it. And the Earth is not so small. It seems also to be. There are also other planets, of course, but all the planets in the habitable zone seem to be more or less about that size. There are, of course, much bigger planets also in other solar systems, but they are in a place where there cannot be, at least not this kind of life that we know. And and I don't know, did you see the interview that they made to Captain Kirk? I don't remember his name, his real name there.
Shatner? Is that Shatner?
Yeah. Shatner,
William Shatner.
William Shatner, okay. And he, at the age of 90, I think it was 1 year or 2 years ago, he went into space with his private little space capsule of Origins space is its name. And he said that when he went to space, he wanted to have this contact with the whole cosmos and the space and out there. And when he went, then when he turned back, he said he had exactly the opposite experience. He looked down to the Earth and said, how precious is that little blue dot in the universe? I did not at all feel this contact with the space outwardly, but identified with this one and unique pearl that is our planet. And I don't remember now the exact words. Just Google it. It's interesting to see how... And this is a very typical experience of many astronauts. When they go to space, and I think that, of course, I'm speculating here, but my intuitive impression is that the space station, which costs so much money, has not been built to make experiments or research or whatever. It has been built to give humanity the sense of unity. If you Google it on YouTube, you can see a lot of real-time images of the Earth from the space station. And people, when they speak about the space station, they usually speak about these images of the Earth from space. And then they show you 4K or 8K videos of the Earth from the space station. That was probably the real function, the occult function of the space station, that to give us this drive towards unity. Because when you see these images from up above, you don't see countries, you don't see nations, not nationalities. You see one living being of which we are part of. Yeah. And this transpires in this last part, at least for me.
So next time we will read this again?
Yeah.
That's yeah. What we
used to yeah, do. Yeah. I would say so, yeah, because it's something to digest. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
These things are a bit philosophical, but one can relate this to also to reality, to our everyday experience. I think, yeah, it tells us something. Okay, what should we do? Should we close the session here or?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A little meditation.
Okay.
So, John Robert, your sound used to be much better of the gong than it is today. Mm. I wonder if there's a kind of a setting that you can adjust.
It's because I'm using these instead of a wired microphone.
Oh, okay.
When I use the wired microphone, it's much clearer.
Oh, okay. Anyway, we get it anyway.
Yeah.
Love being with you.
Okay, thank you very much, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for the time together.
Oh, yes.